We are talking once again with Job Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's, and actually the previous week's news.
Yeah, well, we missed last week, but we're here this week. So
we are. Yay. So,
yay us.
So both we had passing of two folks that I am pretty sure listeners will be familiar with that happened last week. One yeah. is Gary Owens, who is the who's a former Black Panther member and co-founder of Lilo, which the people who have been listening to, who had listened to Mind Over Matters over the years, once upon a time, Lilo was a monthly show that we carried for a couple of years. And just an amazing pillar of the community. He's also Cindy Domingo's partner and was just one of those people that built his work on those that came before him and
mentored many, many people.
Yeah. And just like was a walking encyclopedia of like local history and, you know, community led resistance. And is just, I know it's a cliche, but it's really big shoes to fill. And
yeah.
So major loss there.
Yeah.
And then William Rivers Pitt, who is the, I believe was the lead editor or the chief editor, whichever, and lead writer at Truth Out.
He started it, didn't he?
He very well might have.
And he was not that old either. He's relatively young.
Yeah, he at 51 is what I read.
Wow.
And I believe it was of a heart attack, but regardless, that's way too young to go.
Yeah.
Plenty of work ahead for all of us, but two shining examples of if you're looking for yardsticks to measure
yeah,
your accomplishments.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They'll both be missed a great deal.
So, a week back... the beginning of last week, I believe Bruce Harrell trotted out his budget, which
his budget proposal. Now it still has to go to city council, and city council will, take public input for the next month or so, and then start adding or deleting amendments and. They generally try to have the budget passed by around Thanksgiving, but that will be the main order of city council business for the next couple of months. So, it's worth taking a look at what Harrell has proposed, and what city council is likely to want to change. I believe you have some audio from Mr. Harrell.
So yeah, Erica Barnett had written last week about the Harrell budget proposal, and she had pointed out that in 2019 that then City Council President Bruce Harrell had voted for annual increases to human service providers pinned to the inflation rate with the intent of making sure the low-paid workers' wages at least kept up with inflation. And he had not only supported the proposed increase back then, but he'd actually also proposed an amendment to further strengthen the law that city council was voting on. So he was very wed to this idea back then. And his current budget that he's proposing is basically eliminating that increase
wow.
that they had voted on unanimously back then. So I just thought for context, we could play that here real quick. It's about
sure.
4.5 minutes.
So this is from 2019.
Please read the report of the Housing, Health, Energy, and Workers' Rights Committee. The report of the Housing, Health, Energy, and Workers' Rights Committee, Agenda Item 3, Council Bill 119542, relating to contracting by the Human Services Department, providing that the Seattle Human Services Department provide a cost increase when renewing or renegotiating contracts to address escalation in costs and specifying how and when to apply the increase, amending Section 20.60.102 of the Seattle Municipal Code to exempt human services contracts from the provisions of Chapter 20.60 and adding a new Section 3.20.060 to the Seattle Municipal Code. The committee recommends the bill passes amended.
Thank you very much. Councilmember Mosqueda.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. I would love to maybe speak at the end and also support you in your amendment. If you'd like, I could either second your amendment or move your amendment.
Okay, so would you like to take the amendment first for the base legislation?
Yes, please.
Okay, so I will move amendment, I guess I'll call it amendment number one, and in addition, you have a copy of the amendment, and it was properly circulated on a timely basis, and I want to thank central staff for that. Basically, what it does is we heard a lot of testimony about how underpaid the employees doing this kind of work are, and I don't think there was any disagreement. However, it occurred to me that some of the language I thought in the bill could have been a little stronger to making sure that is clearly our intent, and we understand that there are high fixed costs in these nonprofits and other costs that they just don't have control over. But I thought a strong policy statement saying that we get that too, but we also get the fact that these are underpaid jobs and we want to recognize that. So that's what the amendment does, number one. And then number two, we've had, some of us have been around where we've had real tough times, a recession and where we had to really sharpen our pencil to make some tough cuts. And some policy statements that we had, this around 2008 or so, some policy statements that we said during then were, while we have to make these real tough cuts, that the work that you all do, the work that human services do, we are preserving. That the work is so critical to protect our most vulnerable that in our budget deliberations, this is so critically important that we recognize we have to preserve, if not even enhance the funding. So the other language of this amendment captures that, and I think it's read by saying that the critical role, we recognize the critical role that human services organizations fill, and it's our intent to fund annual adjustments in times of both economic prosperity and economic hardship. So that's what the amendment does, and I will formally move it. Move it consistent with what I just described. Councilmember Mosqueda's second it. Any other comments on the amendment?
I'll take a comment, Mr. President.
Oh, Councilmember Mosqueda?
I just want to thank you, Mr. President, for bringing this amendment forward. I think it is a really smart idea to make sure that we express the council's strong desire that these annual adjustments are received by our provider organizations, and in dealing with the fixed and variable costs as we create greater stability for the organizations, our desire is absolutely in line with what both the CEOs, the executive directors, and the frontline staff have said. We want to see wages stabilize. We want to see workers stabilize and the turnover and vacancy rates addressed. So I really appreciate you underscoring that in the amendment. I also think it's important that we, through your amendment, underscore our commitment to investing in the critical role that these human service provider organizations, frontline staff, and their leaders provide to our city, and by fulfilling the city's intention to fund the annual adjustments in times of both economic prosperity and economic hardship, I think really recognizes that more people are going to need these various services, especially in times of economic hardship. Very much appreciate you bringing this forward and working with our office on this, and we'll be an enthusiastic yes on your amendment.
Thank you, Councilmember Mosqueda. Sir, like, we have a few newlyweds here, sort of like those wedding vows, for better or for worse. Okay. Any more comments before we vote on the amendment? Okay, it's been moved and seconded. All those in favor of the amendment only, just the amendment, please vote aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The ayes have it. The legislation is amended. I'll turn it back over to Councilmember.
Okay. So a couple of things. Mm-hmm. First of all, that city staff person who read the text of the amendment at the beginning really needs to get a second job doing voiceovers at the end of prescription drug commercials.
Yeah, that's an amazing talent.
where they list all the side effects.
Uh-huh.
You may grow a second head, blah, blah, blah. So what has changed between 2019 and now that Mr. Harrell has decided to renege on that commitment? Well, number one, we had a major pandemic, which massively increased the workload of human service organizations. and increase the burnout and potential turnover of their staff. It seems to me the whole for better or for worse thing, we're in a time of for worse, and that is a time when that funding needs to be doubled down on. It doesn't need to be cut. I mean, there were a number of aspects of Harold's proposed budget that I think City Council will want to take a meat cleaver to over the next couple of months. And an important part of that process, of course, is the public comment. And, listeners who have strong feelings one way or another should make those voiced to City Council. And a lot of the City Council, are committees that deal with specific areas of oversight of the city government, and therefore the departmental budgets for that government, will be having hearings that will take public comment over the next month. We'll start mentioning those as they come up in the calendar. They're starting, I believe, next week. So,
yeah.
The big headline to Harold's proposed budget was a massive increase in spending on SPD, which takes up about roughly half of the city's budget. $740 million out of the $1.6 billion general fund is devoted to public safety. That's a little bit misleading, because part of it is a sleight of hand where he's not actually increasing, say officers on the street. He is moving parking enforcement back to SPD from SDOT. Remember, it was moved to SDOT, or those proposed to move to SDOT in 2020 as a result of the George Floyd protests. That was one of the, big early cuts to SPD's budget, was by, moving parking enforcement out of sworn officers you don't really need somebody carrying a gun to be able to write parking tickets. But that's what we're paying for, and the amount of overtime and the salaries of those officers represented a huge overspending. Mr. Harrell decided to move the parking enforcement back to SPD. That, of course, increases the SPD's budget by quite a bit. The proposed budget expands funding for the SPD by $20 million by transferring the parking enforcement back to the department. So that seems designed mostly to get good headlines, or at least what Harrell would consider good headlines. And of course, the Seattle Times and most local TV stations happily followed suit and didn't provide any context for that. The other interesting thing in and we'll start breaking down the specific budget proposals once the committees start hacking away at them and considering amendments. The other interesting thing was homelessness. The King County Regional Homelessness Authority is receiving a very modest increase in funding in its second full year of operation, as opposed to the homelessness authority's request, which was to receive a massive increase in funding. The massive increase in funding, according to the homelessness authority, and I think they're probably right, was necessary to try and, get their arms around, literally at least 10,000 people sleeping on the streets every night in Seattle. There's not adequate shelter for them. There are not adequate services, not adequate, mental health counseling or substance abuse counseling, any of those kind of things. All of the funding now is being moved through the most of the city of Seattle's budget, because the city of Seattle is providing a lot of the funding for the homelessness authority. King County Council's proposed budget, or rather Dow Constantine, the King County executive's proposed budget, also had a very modest increase for the homelessness authority. So I think that's something that city council will look carefully at. All in all, it's going to be very interesting to see what parts of Harold's budget survive, what has become, a more conservative council with Sarah Nelson on a council and Deborah Hoare as being the council president. But you still got some of the same people like Teresa Mosqueda, who we heard in that clip, who are still on council and probably have very good memories for the kind of commitments, not only that the council unanimously made 3 years ago, but that Bruce Harrell himself so enthusiastically supported. That was an interesting clip.
Sure, he's probably working to have that scrap from the archives.
Yeah.
The archives. Seattle Channel.
He will have that text deleted.
Yes, well, speaking of...
Let's talk about that. That happened last week also. We found out that the infamous text messages from that were deleted from the accounts of not only Mayor Jenny Durkan, but also several people in the leadership of public safety in Seattle during the first few days of the George Floyd protests in 2020, those texts were mysteriously deleted. And the excuse, and I use that word very pointedly, the excuse of Mayor Durkan was that, well, these texts were set to automatically delete and we didn't realize that. No. We found more deleted texts. This is according to a report that was issued containing a filing from business owners and residents suing the city over damages allegedly occurred during the 2020 protests. Apparently there were not only more texts than we previously known that were deleted from Mayor Durkan's phone, those additional texts, nearly 200 of them, were deleted manually. In other words, somebody had to go through and actually pick out which text to delete. Then SPD Chief Carmen Bess was another of the people whose phone texts were mysteriously deleted, as were several other people in SPD leadership. And this smacks of not only a cover-up but a conspiracy. And it is under the state's Open Records Act, also a criminal violation, or actually a number of criminal violations. And the fact that this was done manually really speaks to intent to cover up what the decision-making process was, particularly around the decision to abandon these SPD's East Precinct building on Capitol Hill that was besieged by protesters for several weeks. And that in turn led to the creation of the CHOP/CHAZ zone and everything that came after that. So this is something that didn't really get as much attention, I think, as it should have in local media. Granted, it's, over 2 years ago now, but it is still important because it speaks to not just the lack of transparency in Jenny Durkan's mayorship, which has continued under Bruce Harrell, I might add, but also the criminality involved, and that it was very intentional. So, not a good look.
Yeah, and just to clarify, we don't know what the texts are. We just have found out that there's further evidence that texts were deleted.
During a critical period where people really wanted to find out what the decisions were, because the official line around the decision to abandon the East Precinct was that neither Durkan nor Best were involved in that decision, that it was done by a lower level of SPD leadership, the site commander. which struck everybody at the time, I think, as being highly implausible. And the fact that the texts were deleted manually during that time period really speaks to that also, that Durkin and Best and others were trying to avoid accountability for that decision.
Yeah, and the number of other people that were involved with deleting texts is really significant as well. I mean, it really shows that this is it's a pretty wide group of people working in multiple departments within the city that all mysteriously had their texts deleted. Moving on, Meta and Facebook getting a little heat.
Well, I should mention also Mayor Harrell announced the appointment of Anthony Diaz as interim superintendent of Seattle Parks. That's a major appointment because a lot of people care about parks, and it tends to be one of the more public-facing and controversial positions to hold. Diaz currently is the executive director and assistant general manager of the Los Angeles Department of Recreations and Parks. So he's bringing in somebody from L.A. to run the Parks Department. And we'll see how that turns out. Don't confuse him with the new permanent police chief, who is also named Diaz.
Well, it's interesting too that they basically for SPD they looked internally for their replacement chiefs, and it's interesting that they go outside.
And not only outside, but this is for supposedly an interim appointment. Now, it might give him the inside track to become the permanent head of parks. That would require city council approval. But by naming him interim executive director, he doesn't need to face council appointment council approval for that. So we're seeing again very Trumpian maneuvers from Mr. Harrell in terms of his fondness for interim appointees.
Well, and also given the fact that he is pushing for park rangers or the equivalent thereof for local parks that basically a lot of critics are saying are basically going to be soft cops that will be patrolling the parks.
Yeah, and they'll be patrolling the parks specifically to try and get homeless people out of the parks. That's the whole goal of this, and that's why Harrell is pushing this, because he wants to appear to be tough on homeless, which, you know, pushing people around from neighborhood to neighborhood is an approach that has not worked well for the city over the last 30 years, but that does seem to be what Harrell is falling back on yet again. Of course, it's incredibly cruel to the homeless people themselves, who are really struggling just to survive.
And it's being mirrored in numerous other cities and municipalities across the country, pretty much to the exact same effects.
Yeah, it's true. But again, you know, that's a lot cheaper than actually building affordable housing, which the city is starting to do, but at nowhere near the rate needed to get people off the street who need that housing.
Moving on, Meta and Facebook.
Yes, Meta, which is the parent company of Facebook now, as of earlier this year, intentionally violated Washington's longstanding campaign finance laws 822 times, according to a King County Superior Court judge in his ruling on Thursday. So Meta is now facing potentially millions of dollars in fines for those intentional violations. And bear in mind that not this is being prosecuted by the state, and it's not the first time this that Facebook has been dinged by the state for this. They were I believe it was in 2018, they were fined quite a bit for violations of campaign finance laws, and so they were doing the exact same thing since then, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. And it looks like, you know, they'll face millions of dollars in fines, but that, again, is pocket change for a company like Facebook, which is literally rakes in billions of dollars a year.
Yeah. Although of late.
And, And they do it, just for people who aren't clear about the business model, they do it by selling you, the Facebook user, to their advertisers. They collect data on you so that they can offer advertising that micro-targets people by their interests, by their purchasing habits, by what they browse, because Facebook collects all that data.
They do. They hoover it up.
Yep.
Turn around, sell it off to other people who then turn around and sell it off to other people. And
yes, it's kind of like mortgages. It gets resold so many times you don't know who has it at the end.
Yeah, and it's probably pretty inaccurate by the time it takes a couple bounces. Not that it was accurate to begin with, but.
Yeah, if you've ever done a FOIA request for your FBI file, they're like that too. Something about large institutions being unable to keep their data straight. It's very, very concerning because in the case of Facebook, you have no way of examining what data has been collected on you, whether it's accurate or not, and whether it's going to people you want it to go to or not. You have no idea.
None. Yeah. All right.
And, you know, social media companies in general have completely evaded any kind of accountability under the law because Congress has not been functional enough to catch up to the technology. And this is, you've heard Senator Elizabeth Warren, for example, talk for years about the need to break up big tech and to regulate them. And they have so far managed to buy off enough legislators in both parties to be able to avoid that.
Yeah. Well, that part of our system appears to still be working fine.
Yeah, that will be the last to go. The corruption will be the last to go.
So a couple of quick local items. Local hospital chain is being affected by this. But on Monday or Tuesday, I heard from Tim Harris, former Real Change editor, director.
Yes, who's down in Tacoma now.
Yeah, about to start up a new paper there. Very exciting. But so he was going in for some surgery, and his appointment was canceled at the last minute, and they were basically told, we can't get access to our computers. And it turns out that Common Spirit Health, which is the company that owns numerous hospitals locally, and appears that they've been hacked. And
really,
the rumor is that they've been down since Monday and are still down as of today. And it's supposedly theory is it's a ransomware attack.
Oh yeah, and hospitals that have been particular targets for ransomware for several years now.
Yeah,
but you would think that a company that large, I mean, Virginia Mason is one of the largest providers in the state, would have good protection against ransomware. But not necessarily.
Yeah, and you just have to look at the impact of something like that when, a major hospital chain gets taken offline and people aren't getting surgeries. And literally doctors were using the old-fashioned paper just to make notes,
Wow. That's what a concept. Yeah.
Kind of disturbing. The other item that I saw from this week, Erica Barnett once again reporting for Publicola that the King County Jail in downtown Seattle has lacked potable water since Thursday, September 29th. And that basically.
My goodness. So that's basically 10 days tomorrow.
Yeah. I didn't see. She posted the article on the 6th, so a couple days ago. But again, they're basically being handed bottled water. They're only allowed to have one bottled water with them at a time. And there's no indication on how often anyone is checking on them to make sure they have enough water.
Yeah, and, one bottle of water is not enough to get through the day or even part of the day.
Definitely not.
So, yeah, that's a health issue for sure.
Yeah, and it's not the first time King County Jail continues to have problems. They had heating problems previously. It's
Yeah, that's an old building, and its systems badly need upgrading. But they're only prisoners, right?
So moving on to National.
Yeah.
All right. Also saw item last night that the Uvalde School District announced Friday that it had suspended its entire police force amid ongoing fallout from officers' failed response to the mass shooting at Robb Elementary.
Yeah, and not only the failed response, but the cover-up of the failed response, because the police force had a number of stories that it trotted out as to why it didn't respond. And as it turned out, they were all false. The police officers were literally outside the door for more than half an hour while shots were being fired inside, and they were just standing there because they didn't have any orders to do anything. So they did. They didn't. It was a massive failure. You don't want to necessarily go barging into a hail of bullets. At the same time, that's what you have supposedly highly trained police officers for, is to be able to respond to those kind of emergency situations, and they didn't. And Uvalde parents are understandably incensed. And they had already forced the resignation of the police chief of that unit, and now the entire police force has been suspended.
They had parents who had lost children there, who were literally for weeks now had been like camping in front of the doors of the district offices and doing, you know, what we would call direct actions.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't have to worry about child care, right? I mean, God, what a mess. Very, very tragic all the way around.
Well, now seeing the effects of Ian.
Yeah, which is finally come and gone. But particularly in Florida, the devastation is enormous, something like $70 or $80 billion debt damages all told in Florida and the Carolinas and, you know, other places up the coast where Ian dumped a lot of rain. And you're starting to see now calls for limits on beachfront properties and rebuilding in areas that are prone to natural disasters. And of course, by natural disasters, with climate change, those are not only going to become more frequent, but they're also, with rising sea levels, every time you have a major storm blow through, you're going to lose a little bit of land. And for anybody who's been to Florida, a lot of communities are literally built on sandbars and barrier islands, places like Sanibel Island, which is still cut off from the mainland outside Fort Myers, Florida, because the only bridge linking that island to the mainland was cut off. So there's about 7,000 year-round residents that have had to be evacuated. And that's just one community. We know that most of the deaths caused by Ian were of elderly residents who drowned during the storm surge or flooding of local rivers. And there's just an enormous amount of water that came with that storm. And of course, let's talk about rapid intensification, because that also will be, with climate change, a phrase that we're going to hear more and more. And we've seen it the last several years with a couple of hurricanes that hit Louisiana in 2019, with Michael in 2020, and again with this. These are storms that weren't all that powerful initially, and then as they approached land, they suddenly blew up. Ian was supposed to be maybe a Category 1 or 2 storm, and suddenly it got to the strength nearly of a Category 5, one of the most powerful hurricanes ever to hit land in the United States. And it did so because it was passing over relatively shallow and historically warm waters in the Gulf of Mexico, and those warm waters fed the hurricane, with enough moisture to enable it to become much more powerful in a very short period of time, literally hours. Of course, the beachfront communities in Florida and other communities paid the price for that. And it could have been much worse because Ian also shifted course relatively late in its trajectory so that it hit, the area along Southwest Florida's coast, Naples and Fort Myers and Sarasota, rather than having a direct hit on the Tampa Bay area, which is much more populous. That's over 3 million people. They were spared a direct hit. There was a lot of flooding in Central Florida away from the coastline. Because again, the soil had been saturated and there was no place for the water to go. Most of Florida is pretty flat. So it doesn't drain quickly. And so it just, collected in neighborhoods and where people live and you saw mobile homes floating away and all other sorts of, unfortunate incidents. And then the same story as it went up the coast, it lost wind speed, although it did become a hurricane again once it was over the Atlantic before it plowed into South Carolina. There were several deaths in the Charlotte area because of flooding. So on as it moved up through into the Appalachians and West Virginia and dissipated. But it dumped a lot of rain over West Virginia and Pennsylvania as well. So once again, we had a relatively mild hurricane season. Hurricane season officially ends at the beginning of October. Although, in recent years we've had hurricanes as late as November. So it's not necessarily over, but, so far, Ian has been the only major storm to hit the U.S. mainland, but we've seen storms also, historically sized storms in the Pacific, hitting Japan and South Korea, and causing a ton of damage. So, this will be the new normal. This is what climate change looks like. And I think the discussions that are happening now and that happen every time there's a major, hurricane or other powerful storm hitting the U.S., we have these discussions about, well, why are we insuring, these beachfront properties and just rebuilding every time they get knocked down by a hurricane. And what we're starting to see is even though local municipalities aren't taking any action, the insurance companies are. You can't get flood insurance in a lot of Florida right now. And many homeowners in Florida discovered to their chagrin after their properties were destroyed that their insurance did not cover flood insurance. So, they're out of luck. And they lost everything, which is very sad. But, again, that a lot of that responsibility goes back to local jurisdictions and developers who are, building developments and properties in these areas that are almost guaranteed to, have a catastrophic natural disaster, at some point. You just don't know exactly when, but you know the odds are it's going to happen just by the historical record. And those storms are getting more frequent and more vicious as time goes on. That's going to keep happening.
And the victims, the people who are suffering from this, tend to be the very poor because they can't, unlike the rich who have the means for moving out on a moment's notice to somewhere else, when you're poor, it's like you really, it's a nice thought to pack up and leave, but a lot of folks don't have that as an option.
And Florida is full of retirees, and some of those people are not in great health and not particularly mobile. They might be disabled. They might have health issues that prevent them from moving around very easily. They might not have relatives in the immediate area that they can easily go to, because they retired from Michigan or New York or wherever. And that's where their family is. It's a difficult situation. And of course, Florida being one long peninsula means you have to drive a pretty long way to get out of the hurricane's path when it's coming, straight up through the state the way Ian did. I should mention also that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was notably quiet about accepting federal aid this time, even though he has lambasted the federal government as illegitimate and noisily refused to accept aid for things like health insurance or vaccines or pandemic relief. But he's more than happy to accept the federal assistance in the disaster declaration and all the rest of it when a major storm. Climate change, which according to DeSantis does not exist, hits the state.
Well, let's move on to developments that have happened with the Trump crime family.
Yeah, well, there's been a lot going on over the past couple of weeks. The Trump-appointed judge in Florida, Judge Aileen Cannon, who has been making life miserable by siding with Trump at every possibility as the Justice Department attempts to use the documents that were seized in Mar-a-Lago. She had appointed a special master to review the documents to see which ones could be excluded from the Justice Department's investigation on the basis of attorney-client privilege or on the basis of executive privilege, which makes no sense since Trump is no longer the president and therefore cannot claim executive privilege, although he says that they were protected by executive privilege because before he left office, he thought about declassifying those documents. Well, you can't declassify them just by thinking about it. There's a whole process you have to go through. There's paperwork that has to be filed, all the rest of it. None of that ever happened. And in Trump's legal defense, he had never previously claimed that those documents had been declassified. So, but Cannon nonetheless sided with him. Some of that opinion, the part particularly where the Justice Department was prohibited from using the seized documents in its criminal investigation, and the intelligence community could not use it as part of its damages assessment to find out whether any of those documents had been, say, shared with adversaries like Saudi Arabia or Russia. That part was overturned by the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, which a three-judge panel, including two judges appointed by Trump. But Cannon had gone ahead and appointed a special master to review the documents on a delayed timeline. They won't be finished until late November, which is, of course, after the midterms. But Cannon overruled her own special master to say that that some of these documents did have to be reviewed, even though the special master didn't think they did. The Department of Justice has already reviewed them, so the government had argued that special master was superfluous for any of this. But Cannon overruled that. Meanwhile, another headline from Trump World: a former high-up official in the Trump re-election campaign and a Turning Point USA events coordinator and pederast, a guy named Adam Hickman, was sentenced to 66 months in prison for charges relating to child pornography, possession and distribution of child pornography. This keeps happening to Republicans. This is the Family Values Party as we know it now, the party of Jeffrey Epstein, basically. This week didn't get a lot of attention, but the National Archives had announced that they believe that Trump still has classified documents that have not been returned to the federal government, that even though the FBI has gotten three tranches previously from Trump's lawyers or through their raid in early August at Mar-a-Lago, that Trump still has more squirreled away in various parts of his estate. So it's going to be very interesting to see how the government wants to proceed with that, whether there's going to be another raid and so forth. It's a very serious situation in terms of Trump's threat to national security. He is a threat to national security at this point.
I was remembering that when his former wife was being buried on a golf course in New Jersey.
Yeah, that was a class act.
Yeah, and there was a lot of theory as to did anybody like look in the casket to see if there were big boxes of documents in there instead.
Yeah, well, at least that would be safe from falling into the hands of, you know, foreign powers, unless they, of course, thought to, you know, disinter the wife.
President Biden making a surprising announcement regarding marijuana.
Yeah, this was on Thursday, and it's a long overdue step to take, but it's good that he took it. He pardoned thousands of people who've been convicted federally of possession of marijuana. Now, this is something that marijuana continues to be a scheduled of a class one drug in the same class as heroin and LSD. He has not changed that. But bear in mind that this is Joseph Biden, who in his career as senator from Delaware, you know, through the 2000s, he had been a committed drug warrior who had, encouraged stiff sentences for drug possession, including marijuana possession, and had been adamant for years and years and years and years and years that this was necessary and could not be changed. So it was a surprise announcement, and it's good to see that he's finally moving on this issue. I have never understood that why more politicians in either party don't campaign on decriminalization of marijuana. It's still a crime to even possess it, let alone distribute it at the federal level. And that's where a lot of convictions have come as states increasingly legalize it, either for certainly for medical purposes, but also in at least a dozen states now for recreational purposes, including Washington State. And of course, as we know, because it's been illegal here for several years, the sky has not fallen in. You know, civilization has not collapsed, at least not from that, and not yet. You know, we all survived the Trump years, so I would imagine that, consumption of weed increased quite a bit during the Trump years as people relieved their stress. Good to see that from President Biden, and that will enable a number of people to get on with their lives, with their pardons. Now, in order to don't you as part of a presidential pardon have to admit guilt? That part seems odd because, you know, something that is not a crime in many places now, except federally, people served long stretches in prison and had their lives destroyed basically over marijuana possession, and at least that has been expunged from people's records. Good to see.
Or will be,
yes.
Yeah, my readings on it was that the number of federally people or people federally detained for possession of marijuana is somewhere between 6,000 and 7,000 people have been serving time for that.
So, yeah.
Generally, federally, they pursue the people who are selling and or transporting.
Yes, and the number of people who've been convicted under state or local laws for marijuana possession, I would have to guess is in the millions. So it's a drop in the bucket, but it is an important drop in the bucket. So yeah, let's talk about some local judicial rulings this week. A federal judge temporarily blocked parts of New York State's new weapons law after a previous Trump-appointed federal judge had overturned New York's longstanding, much more restrictive law on sale of firearms. So the Gun Owners of America had sued. That's a nonprofit grassroots lobbying organization that is probably not very grassroots, honestly. The federal judge has blocked implementation of the new New York State law, so that which was designed to comply with the previous judicial ruling, so that Gun Owners of America can sue in court to challenge the legislation as being unconstitutional, because God forbid anything get between your right to own, you know, 70 bazillion weapons of war. Also, we had this week abortion rights supporters won two important victories, although temporary, on Friday when judges in Ohio and Arizona suspended state laws that completely banned the procedures. In Ohio, a county judge indefinitely suspended a state law prohibiting most abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. And on the same day, an appeals court in Arizona temporarily blocked its pre-statehood law that banned the procedure entirely and that had been reimposed by the state legislature after the Dobbs ruling in June. So, good news, maybe fleeting, but definitely good.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And then we had this week in the mass shootings file. Although actually on Thursday we had a spate of mass knifings. The shooting came in Thailand, where a former military trained police officer with the National Police, he had been kicked off the force in June for meth possession. And I'm sure there's more of a backstory there that we haven't heard yet. But he went into a child care center after killing his wife and young daughter at home, and killed 36 additional kids and staff people at that child care center. Really horrific attack with not only a gun but also a knife. And then we also had a couple other mass knife attacks. Something that didn't get that much attention because it was on the same day in Las Vegas. A guy who has not been caught yet, as far as I know, was walking up and down the Vegas Strip, asking dancers from the various hotels to pose for him, posing pictures for him, so he could take selfies. And when they refused, he knifed them and killed several and injured a number of others. It smacks of an incel attack, but we don't know the details of it because he has not been caught as yet. And then there was also a gentleman who randomly knifed several people in London on the same day. So something in the air. Maybe the bad air went over China and then came back here. We just don't know. The thing with the knife attacks is that it can be so much worse if it's a firearm. And there's so many of those firearms in the United States now that it's really quite frightening. So a lot of disturbed people.
Yeah. A lot of disturbed people. All right, let's jump. Got a few minutes left. Let's jump to updates in Ukraine.
Yeah, several important developments the last couple of weeks in Ukraine. Of course, first on the list would be the fake referendums for four Ukrainian provinces in the south and east that were held by Russia, and that are, to nobody's surprise whatsoever, Russia announced that their citizens overwhelmingly wanted to become part of Russia, and so Russia has now announced that those areas are part of Russia, and then if Ukraine attacks them, it is attacking the Russian motherland. The referenda and the subsequent annexation is not being recognized, of course, internationally by pretty much anyone. But it is what Russia is claiming right now, and it's what its own citizens are being told. And there were reports also of people being forced to vote in that referendum and forced to vote a particular way in that referendum. Secondly, this just happened today, their time. The long bridge that Russia built after its 24 annexation of Crimea that links the Russian mainland to the Crimean Peninsula, that was blown up. A truck bomb went off. It not only took out two of the four lanes of the roadway, which are now in the Gulf of Azaz. It's, you know, you can see the pictures that they're literally in the water. But it, there's also an elevated rail line that is above the motorway, and that was also damaged. So Russia is saying it was a terrorist attack. We don't know the provenance of it. It seems extremely unlikely from the timing and placement of it that it was random, but we just don't know at this point. But that is a huge development because it really cuts it makes much more difficult access to the Crimean Peninsula from Russia. Now, Crimea also is accessible, of course, since it's a peninsula from occupied Ukraine. That area north of Crimea is all occupied by Russia at this point, but it may not be for long. So, you know, Ukraine continues to advance on the battlefield. The other major development, which didn't get a lot of attention this week in U.S. media, was the Nobel Peace Prize, which was shared by human rights activists from Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia. That was announced yesterday. And, you know, the Nobel committee tends to be very political in its decisions as to who gets the Nobel Peace Prize. And, you know, in this case, it could be seen as a pretty strong rebuke to Russian President Vladimir Putin. And, of course, in Belarus, his authoritarian ally there, Lukashenko, rebuked to him as well. So good to see that, and good to see those activists not just being recognized internationally, but also there's a substantial amount of prize money that goes with that to help them continue their work.
All right. And quickly, finally, Cuba.
Yes, Cuba has now approved same-sex marriage, which is something that you've seen across Latin America here or there over the past few years. I think Mexico was the first several years ago, but it's some Central and South American countries have followed suit. But Cuba had not, and now it has. So that's very good news. Again, another advance for human rights.
All right. So, thought we'd end on a upbeat note.
Yeah, we try and include at least one upbeat thing every month, every week.
That's about what it averages out to.
Yeah, well, as I Freudian slip, right?